Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 165, being recorded on the 8th of February, 2017, with special guest Travis Falls. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guest Travis. And before we give Travis a chance to introduce himself and to talk about a very interesting topic, which somehow we just never got to before, but we'll get to that in a minute. Let's just do a quick roundup of all the latest news in the Azure space. And thanks, guys, for putting a lot of links in the show notes this week. It's been a busy week. What gives, Evan?
You got me. I try and keep up with it just as much as everybody else. I don't know. I think some of this is still everybody, you know, slowed down over the holidays, and now they ship their code, right? Now it's starting to GA and the like. But, you know, if we keep saying that, we're just going to be like, well, maybe this is the new pace. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just some good stuff in there, and I know Kale's going to jump in on a couple of things, but we'll hold him off for a little bit. Let's get started on. What do you like, Evan?
So the two that I thought were the most interesting, and part of this is because I'm digging into this service myself right now, but Azure Active Directory Domain Services, right? This is basically a managed DC, right? Mm-hmm. So you deploy this managed DC in your VNet in Azure, you hook it into your Azure Active Directory, and now you can do things like group policy, domain join, all the stuff you do with DC. More features coming, and you know, it doesn't do everything a DC does, but that's the vision, that's the path. Because again, same thing I say about Exchange servers, right? Everybody needs a DC function, needs DC functionality, but nobody really wants to run a DC, right? Because DCs are throwaway, individual DCs. So this kind of is down this path. And what we've done is we're, you know, kind of rolling this out more broadly, right? The other one that I saw, and this one, we may have to go do a whole show to kind of understand what we're doing here, but this Azure IP Advantage.
I was looking at that, actually, yeah. You know what's funny? When I first saw that, I thought it was something to do with IP addresses.
That's right, too, and I was going, what the heck is this?
Like, oh, maybe they treat now our IP addresses in a special way or something, I don't know.
Yeah, so I went and read it, and basically what we're doing is we're saying, and again, not a lawyer here, this is just my interpretation, but we're basically saying, if you run your stuff in Azure, we have our, and I think the number was like 10,000 patents that you can use we will let you use to protect yourself if somebody sues you, you know, and you can, you know, based on patent infringement, if you're running in our cloud.
And I guess part of the, part of the thing is because Azure itself, take things like HD Insight and other products that we have.
A lot of open source stuff.
A lot of open source in Azure itself as part of our offering, right?
Yep.
And the customers are using it. So by kind of by proxy, they are using that source code as well.
Yep.
And if someone goes out and says, and I guess there's a lot of these baseless lawsuits that are flying around, they say, oh, you know, they wait for a company to become successful and then they'll sue them, right? That's typically the way it goes. And that's what we're doing now. It's what we were saying. We've got you covered for, you know, for a bunch of these IP things, so don't be worried. I think it's pretty good, though.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting offering, right? Because you would never do that on premises.
Yes.
But here we're saying, hey, if you're running in our environment, here's this additional protection you get. So really, really cool thing. I don't totally understand all of it yet, but seems really cool.
So before we let Kale go out on the blockchain ones, I want to just talk about the Azure Marketplace update, which is kind of nice. So they've kind of given a more interactive feel to the Azure Marketplace. As you know, that's where you can go and find all sorts of, blogging engines or solutions, security solutions, CRM solutions, etc. That you can directly, you know, with a click of a button, get them up and running in Azure. But I think in the past, it was kind of difficult to compare and figure out what that was going to cost you. Like, you know, you would see something that you like, and then you would say, oh, yeah, let me try it out.
And then after a month, you got a big bill, and you're like, oh my God, this is much more expensive than I thought. So now they've kind of put all that, they're giving you a lot more data right up front to tell you, okay, this is probably what it's going to cost you if you have this kind of usage with this particular kind of offering or product. And so it's a little more interactive and lets you kind of find what you want and pick the one that's right for you easily. And then they have a good trial mechanism too, right? Where you can try it for a little while without any cost. So that's also built into the new marketplace. So I think that's a good thing with the marketplace update.
Yeah, it's a subtle thing, but I think it really moves towards making it easier for you to use this third-party stuff, right, on the Azure platform.
And then something that's very close to me from a customer perspective, because my customers have been waiting for this for a long time, is the managed disks. And this has been in preview in a while, I think, and now it's finally out there available. So managed disks, right now, if you have to deal with storage, you got to worry about which storage account I'm using, and all sorts of attributes. Each one of these accounts has different, excuse me, security profiles and things like that. And they've taken away all of that. Right now, it's very simple. Microsoft manages the disk for you. You just tell what the size is, and you're good to go. Whether you want, I guess, more like an SSD or regular storage, and then they take care of everything. So they've simplified the management of disks. You can kind of grow that as you need it. You can say, I need 10,000 disks, and boom, you get 10,000 disks, right? I mean, I guess boom is a bit too fast, but you'll get 10,000 disks relatively quickly as opposed to
Evan
trying to
gets a
wait.
call. You say, I want 10,000 disks, and Evan gets a call.
That's right.
Exactly.
Like, oh.
And then shortly after that, boom, then there's your managed disks.
So I thought that was a cool thing. Okay, Evan. I mean, Akhil, go ahead. What's all this
Let's
blockchain stuff
see.
coming
What
out
is he
there?
gonna talk about this week?
So I'll welcome you to the blockchain corner of the podcast. No, just two quick ones. I was in San Francisco 2 weeks ago, and there was a couple things up about that. But one of the things that we kind of put out there was some identity work that we're working on. So just like from a blockchain perspective, we did a lot of work on the infrastructure side to get the chains running up there, as you said, like marketplace and making that easy. But now we're kind of moving up the stack a bit into the middle tier. So for storage, identity, key management, these kind of things. This is kind of one of the first things that we're doing there. And so we're working with a couple partners on that to provide an attestation service. It's like a future kind of identity service. And then also when we were in San Francisco, we talked at the conference there, Construct, which was a lot of blockchain developers. And in that conference, we basically just talked about some of the use cases that we've been seeing and are getting close to pilot with Webjet, which is a travel booking site in Australia, and then Mojix with a retail experience. So good stuff happening in blockchain world.
That's cool. And I actually use Webjet. I've used them a couple of times already. They're very, very, very cost effective. A good travel website. And so they're using blockchain. Wow, that's interesting. So are they trying to make some sort of a marketplace for travel? Is that the whole idea?
No, it's more of a back-end system.
Okay.
Basically trying to clean up some of the back-end business process that happens, because there's a lot of wholesaling that happens in that market, if you understand how the sale of rooms and stuff like that happens. So there's a lot of moving pieces there, and that's like a common theme, right? To kind of reduce business complexity of like all these integration servers by leveraging something like a blockchain.
Very cool. And then, Evan, I don't know if you saw this one about the Document DB. A common complaint has been that we've had on the show is that Document DB is too expensive to get started, right? And I guess the big news this week is that the entry point for Document DB just got cheaper now. It's
A lot
75%
cheaper.
cheaper. So that's something that our listeners should watch out for. If they want to try Document DB and they're worried about, the cost of entries being too high, it's a lot more cost effective, especially if you're using a partition collection. And then did you see the one about the encryption for the file storage? Which I thought was pretty good, because we've talked about Azure Files in the past, and that's like the SMB service that we offer in Azure. But the underlying, I guess the actual transfer of data for the SMB system was never was not encrypted, and now so the the storage service encryption, SSE as they call it, will now take care of the encryption of that data, which is the file data that you are keeping in Azure. So the file data, while it's at rest, will be encrypted, which I think.
Yeah, I mean that's big. I mean that's really big because I mean if you think about it, at one level you don't care.
Yeah.
Right. As a customer, but on another level, you know, you do want that confidence that, you know, if somebody gets access to that, if somebody, some malicious person in Microsoft, whatever, right? Not that we have any, but it, you know, if there was, right? Theoretically, they get the disk. Oh my God, they got my data. Well, now it's just encrypted data.
Yep.
Right. So there's no value to that at that point. Yeah. And because it's transparent, you just turn it on and you don't have to change anything about what you're doing.
Love it.
Yeah. Agreed.
Okay, so that thing that kind of gives up a good roundup of all the updates, and let's get to our topic of the day and our special guest, Travis. And Travis, I know Kale kind of brought you into the show, and I want to give you a chance to for you to introduce yourself, and then we'll dive into the topic that you care a lot about regarding DSC. So go ahead, Travis. Please tell our listeners something about your background.
Sure. I've been working at Microsoft for 10 years now. My background has been as an application developer and architect for most of the time, working on different consulting projects. As most people, you know, the advent of the cloud, that kind of transitioned me over into the cloud space, and now I've been spending most of my time really helping some major customers work on their code quality in the sense of how that impacts DevOps. So the DevOps piece of it's what brought me to the topic of today of DSE, you know, just falling in with a DevOps crew and really learning some of the magic that they do. It really highlights the importance of the topic.
Great. That's good, and thank you for sharing your experience with our listeners. So I just want to remind everybody that, you know, like it's been over a year now that we, if you recall, we spoke to Scott Zhang, who was a PM in the Azure team, about DSE for Linux, right? And I guess I realized that, you know, we hadn't really explained to our customer, to our listeners about DSE itself. We just kind of dived into DSE for Linux at the time, and it's kind of nice that we have that on Linux, but what's this whole DSC thing about, right? I think, and I'm so glad that Travis also was able to join us and give us a little bit of perspective on that. So Travis, like, you know, when you talk to your customers, what is the, like, how would you characterize the value prop of DSC? Like, what does that bring to the table that, you know, that that is not there before, without DSC, for example?
Well, I think I would probably phrase it maybe, Sajid, as like, why would I do DSC over just a script?
There you go. That's better.
Right. You know what? Because I can do either, but what's the, you know, why should I go learn DSC?
Yep.
Absolutely. So for the customer I was working with, we were helping with a whole broader effort to move them to the cloud, and part of that was taking their infrastructure away from them and putting everything in the cloud, and that involved a lot of ARM templating and things like that, and which is great for standing up, you know, the outer walls of what you want to build. But at that point, when we want to be able to configure what's on those machines and services in some instances, and we want to kind of keep that in sync into like a source control environment, being able to use desired state configuration with the ARM templates and things like that gave them a way to truly build the outer shells of their environment as well as configure and then monitor for drift as they went. So it really it enabled them to have a lot less error-prone setup and disaster recovery story, really.
How does it make it, you know, less error prone? Because, you know, I mean, what does it give you ultimately? I mean, I know ARM templates are very declarative, right? Is that ultimately what DSC ends up bringing, as well as it's, I tell you what I want rather than try having to figure out how I get it to that state?
What it really brings is a way to record what you want, so that you can then source control that whole setting, so it lives as an artifact with your code itself. So the customer that I'm speaking of, they were actually still going into machines and hand configuring them based on scripts that they had written out. By script, I mean actual Word documents with steps.
Yeah.
So by taking the human being out of that equation and allowing these to be versioned the way they were, it really gave them a predictable, you know, type of environment where they know if they stand it up today and then they stand it up tomorrow, they're going to get the desired state every time.
Yeah, I guess I just asked Travis this, like, you know, like Evan, you mentioned, there's multiple ways to kind of skin this. You could say, like, I'm going to do stuff with ARM to basically lay out some basic infrastructure. And I don't think DSC kind of really fits in that model, right? Like, that's more just like pure infrastructure. Let's get the foundation running. But from my feeling, I want to get Travis's feedback on this, was like, DSC to me feels a bit more like at the application level. It's like, now my machine's up and yes, I'm going to put, you know, web bits on this thing. So I need IIS. I need all these other different things, part of Windows or Linux. But basically, it was able to like make sure that those bits were always on there. And if somebody like misconfigured it, it would put it back the way it's supposed to be. And the script was more of like customization. Like I needed to do something that maybe DSC doesn't do so easily or something like that, like really custom.
Yeah, honestly, Kale, you're hitting the nail on the head. That's really what it brought to the table for our customer and what got me interested in it. It's, you know, once you stand up those outer shells of your architecture, there's a lot of customization that's needed depending on, you know, certain regulatory requirements, you know, which ports are allowed to, you know, be influenced. And every customer has really unique things there, and it gets more and more complicated as, you know, the environment gets more complicated. So being able to record that and then execute it over and over again just brings a lot of value. You know, obviously there's other tools that can be leveraged, you know, just custom PowerShell scripts or things like that. But this gives a nice packaged way to do that and turn on, the, like you said, the web bits in a Windows Server environment or something like that.
Yeah, I guess the other thing I was thinking about was, like, you mentioned on-prem. You mentioned you were working with a customer that was doing some maybe, like, migration effort or even some hybrid model. And it feels to me like DSC might be a good fit there as well, like, because it's kind of standardized into these operating systems, so it doesn't really matter if it's running in Azure or on-prem.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it strikes me because, you know, and I was, again, my perspective was always coming in as support, right? You know, all you guys in MCS and in pre-sales, right? Everything always works for you guys. you know, the thing that we always laugh about in support, right, is customers will come in and say, hey, I built this new server and it's just like my old one, but it's not working right. Something's failing somewhere. And what we always find, right, is it's a huge chunk of the time it's human error, right? Somebody forgot to change some registry key that, you know, was in this, you know, in the 40-page document they were walking through, they just missed a step. It sounds like from what you're describing, right, that DSC would allow me to basically turn my 40-page doc into something that I can check into, you know, source code control and, you know, defines what it is my, you know, my setup is, so that when I build my new server, it is exactly like my other server. Right? You're taking that human error out.
That is exactly correct, and it also allows you, when configured in certain ways, to monitor those servers for drift. So did a human go in and change something that shouldn't have been changed?
Oh, yeah.
That would then give you a support call. So it also allows you to monitor for that type of thing. So it kind of gets you from a support aspect. It gets you both things. Like, A, yes, I know this was built the exact same way. It's configured the exact same way. And B, once you're down the road, you'll be able to monitor these environments to make sure they stay that way.
So I've heard that term drift before, and I didn't really get what that meant. So that's going after the fact that no server is really static ever, right? People do things, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, right? You're trying to tackle that. That's what we say. You're drifting off of kind of what you want it to be, and this is another way to tackle that as well.
That is exactly correct. So with that drift that happens there, if you think about from an environment and from just the application, you know, we've kind of stepped up our automation chain here. A couple of years ago, you know, we were really worried and focused on writing great applications, and then the environment took a lot of human effort. Well, now we're kind of taking the approach of, you know, why have a human do something we can have a machine do? Because machines are, you know, inherently good at doing things in a repetitive fashion. So right. we've kind of just taken it a step further now.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that has attracted me to DSC is, especially as it relates to Azure, is VM scale sets, right? This is where I think where DSC really hits home, because VM scale sets allows you to provision, you know, when I say hundreds of servers of identical type, but you also need to be able to attach this, make sure that all these servers are exactly of the same type, right? You don't want to have, like, you know, three servers in the farm be different than the rest. And so DSC really shines, I think, is when you attach it to VMSS, for example, and say, you know, I need to scale up or scale down, especially in the scale-up scenario, it would ensure that all the new servers that are coming online are exactly the same as the other servers that are already online.
Yeah, that would be hard to track down in a skill set, right, where you get random failures. Yeah. I don't think you know, yeah, that'd be, yeah, I can see the value there.
Yep. And then, so like currently I'm working with a customer that's using, that's evaluating Service Fabric, you know, which is my favorite topic. And as you know, Service Fabric, as it's offered in Azure, is based on VM scale sets. And we want to be able to make sure that all these machines in the cluster, in the Service Fabric cluster, are identical. And so DSE was a really natural choice over there as well.
Yeah, and to be clear, maybe we could talk a little bit more for the listeners about what makes up DSC. Like,
yeah.
What components are involved here?
Yeah.
I mean,
what can I do with it? I mean, you said install some web stuff, but like, what does that mean?
How do you author the DSC, whatever configuration, right? And like, what's the kind of workflow involved with creating one like that?
Yeah, and I think we've talked a little bit about this. Like, we're out here in Seattle this week, myself and Travis, and I met up with Donovan, who we had on the show here before, talking about DevOps. And yeah, as you can imagine, he's pretty deep in DSC as well, and very passionate about this area. But yeah, I mean, from a high level, the way I understand it, I just want to get Travis's input here, is like, it's kind of like an agent-based thing, right? Like, we have this agent that's on the machine, so we enable that kind of like feature on our machine, and then we can pass configuration to it. And the ones I've seen, and I just want to see if it changed any, was like, it's basically like JSON, right? It's like a declarative language where I can basically say, here's the features I want to make sure are either there or not there. I can kind of enforce both sides, and then we just have this thing that runs that basically makes that the agent is checking the config of that machine. Is that how you guys are using it as a customer? You guys are using it?
That's 100% correct. So the way we're using it, you know, it's a little foreign for myself, just coming from a dev side. And, you know, from my background, you know, my interactions with DevOps is more of a process standpoint. So now being embedded with a DevOps team, you know, this is such a familiar way for them to address it, because they're very used to dealing with agents and things like that. So basically, you're 100% correct. There's pieces of JSON that you use to configure what you need, and you're passing that in, and that agent kind of takes care of that for you.
And so that's where you were mentioning about the like version control. Like, so you could basically build, this is what my config should look like right now, but like, you know, 6 months from now, we change things a bit, right? The business changes a little bit, or we change how we're running our workloads a little bit. And so we can have, you know, multiple kind of little libraries of these things that we can use to basically provision our infrastructure. So yeah, I guess the ultimate idea here is like, no, humans shouldn't be touching these boxes, right? It's lights out, fire the thing up, and it lays all the bits down, and you got what you need.
100% correct. And, you know, you want to basically have that mentality of no humans involved, but also having that historical record, having all those check-ins into source control, treating this type of, you know, infrastructure as code. This is just part of that. So having that record, you can roll back how we got to where we are. You can really understand that. And so when you tether this DSC type of mentality of keeping everything in check all the time, you really should be able to lower your instances of outages.
Yeah,
yeah, I think we talked. Sorry, go ahead.
Finish what you're saying, Kale.
Yeah, no, I don't remember if it was the talk we had on here on the podcast before, but one of the things I remember someone had mentioned is like the kind of the extreme case of this DSC and this, I guess we call it auto configuration or type, is people can't log into the box, right? Like, admins can't really log into
the box. Oh, yeah, you don't even give them rights. You just let... Right. DSC do it for you.
And DSC can fix the password for you. Yep. Yep.
Go ahead, Evan.
I would say I heard it the other way, and maybe I misheard it, was like, I can configure this box without an admin having to have rights to this box.
Correct, right. But even removing, like, you know, okay, it auto-configured, but we still have RDP active, right? And so somebody could, technically, if they had, you know, they're an admin at the company, log in, but what if that's not even available to them? You know, nobody can log in, you know?
Right.
I was going to say, it does take a little bit of a mentality switch, too. You know, we were kind of trying to eat our own dog food on the team I was on, so we were running this configuration drift against our own servers, and, you know, we happen to also be admins on some of those servers, so we made, you know, some quick changes to do something the old school way, and we had our drift reset and couldn't figure out why our changes weren't really working. So, you got to change yourself, too.
DSC is working too well. Yeah, so what's interesting is that ESC is actually like some sort of an extension of PowerShell, right? I think from PowerShell 4.0 and up, it kind of got introduced. And essentially, it's a set of extensions to PowerShell and some commandlets. By the way, talking of PowerShell, maybe you guys are more up on PowerShell. You know, I don't use it a whole lot until recently. But is it common to refer to PowerShell script as Posh scripts? I've seen that word a lot. Did they call it posh, POSH scripts? When did that start happening?
Let me give my answer here. I'm really curious to hear what Travis and Kale say. So I have a little bit of background here. I have a good colleague of mine who is just a PowerShell whiz, right? And he knows how to code in general, but PowerShell is where he lives, right? Versus I kind of come from the traditional, you know, writing C sharp, bigger apps, and so, you know, I kind of think in that layout. In his world, you know, if he can compress, you know, 40 actions into one line in PowerShell that is all this cryptic, you know, piping this and some weird symbol and it does all that stuff in one line, he thinks that's the coolest code since sliced bread. I look at it and go, well, I can't read that, so I want to expand it out and, you know, have my if blocks really well defined so you can see what it's doing and all that kind of nice comments. And I think Posh is from those folks that everybody in PowerShell wants to shorten stuff because heaven forbid you have two extra characters. That's my take. Curious to hear what you guys think. But
Evan, I write PowerShell the exact same way you do. You know, I come from a very traditional first, C++ and Java, and then right into C#. So I write in a very readable way, and I agree. A lot of PowerShell folks that I know, they take great pride in shortening things as tersely as possible to the point of making it look like a regular expression more than code. So
yeah.
I'm wondering, that makes sense. I actually personally always refer to PowerShell when I want to shorten it as PS1 scripts, but that's just always how I did it.
That's what I call them too, as a PS1 script. But on the internet, people are calling them Posh scripts.
Only PowerShell gurus.
Yes.
I think.
So these let's call them these Posh scripts. It's kind of interesting, right? That it's kind of built into PowerShell, but there's this whole concept with the MOF file, right? That's involved. When I was looking at it, you know, so you have all these. If you create the configuration, the PowerShell the Posh script for your DSC, and you want to get it ready to send to the server, right? You have to first run this PowerShell command, which converts it into a MOF file. And what that does is, MOF is the traditional Microsoft operation framework file, right? I think most of us are familiar with it from the C++ days. So it uses that MOF format to
Like a packaging format or something.
Yeah, exactly. It packages it all into one file instead of, you know, taking all your PowerShell commandlets and so it just makes it into one file, and then that one file is now can be shipped down to the server as one object, you know, and that's it. Yeah.
Right, similar to the WSD days with SharePoint.
Yep. Exactly. So I thought that was interesting that they have this concept of the MOF file, and that makes it easier, right? And then there's this concept of the pull and the push servers, which I thought was interesting. Pull and push, right? When it comes to DSC, you can either push it to a server, to a set of servers, or you can tell the servers, hey, by the way, point to this particular URL, and that's where your MOF file lives, right? And now you just set up this. There's a little bit of a setup involved to set up a pull server, which is basically just an HTTP server. It's a WCF HTTP server. And then all these servers in your forum can point to this one box, and they keep pulling it every so many minutes. And every time they see a difference, they'll pull it down. They'll apply the changes, and then they're in sync. Right? But I think it's pretty cool. Have you guys used either the pull or the push, and which do you prefer?
We're using the pull. I wasn't part of the decision when that was made. That was before I got there, and it seems to work great. You know, my experience from a MOF file is exactly kind of as you described, but more from the consumer. For me, it was just a packaging mechanism that we're reaching out to get everything we need. So for us, that's kind of how we've handled the drift. That's how we've handled, you know, making sure we have, you know, updates getting down to servers. So it's been. We haven't had any issues. It's been a surprisingly easy transition.
Yeah, I guess I would assume that in a pull model, you know, the company like you guys working with, they're probably policing it a little bit, like auditing, right? Absolutely. To make sure, like, if somebody pops a server up there and it's not pulling server, like the scripts or whatnot, the configuration, then it kind of raises an alert. Somebody goes and check out what's happening here.
Yeah. They've actually written some custom security pieces even into it. It's one of their biggest concerns was people being able to inject bad configuration into the pipeline. So they've taken a lot of pains to make sure that doesn't happen.
Right. Okay, that's a good point.
Sort of writing a hash to, you know, to blockchain.
Yep. Yeah, they have a checksum file that goes with it. I know that. With the morph file, and it kind of compares the checksum file, but that's interesting. I was playing around with this over the last couple of days, I said, from my customer, and it takes a little getting used to, right? Not only the setup and the configuration, but as you said, it's a mentality difference, right? If you're coming from a pure developer world, this might seem a little odd. This, I know you call that a JSON file, but I think it's not even a proper JSON file. I was looking at the syntax. It's some sort of a blend between JSON and PowerShell, right?
It is, and you're really just passing data into those PowerShells. It's very similar to kind of how when you have the ARM templates you're making, you know, there's also a big set of ARM PowerShell commands and things
right.
like that.
You can embed it right in there.
Yeah. So it's very similar to that. You know, we refer to it as JSON just because that's what it looks closest like, but it's not. It wouldn't go through you know, any type of validation. That's for sure.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. I don't know. Have they ever done any work with creating like a DSC editor of some sort? Like someone created a
GUI or something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I just wonder if someone's done that. That sounds like a good thing to have. Anyway,
it would be great. I mean, right now it feels a little bit like, you know, stone knives and bearskins for technology of generating this stuff. You know, crack open your favorite Notepad type editor.
There you go. You got to do it the old school way. But that's great, Travis. Really appreciate you sharing your insight into this technology, and hopefully our listeners got something from it. Anything else? Any last things you want to add, Cale and Travis? I know Evan had to jump.
No, this has been great. I appreciate Travis coming on and sharing his experience with this with DSC, and you know, DevOps is a huge part of the cloud and all the stuff that we do. So this is one of the key kind of components to make this stuff real, you know.
I agree. Yeah, DSC has got to be in any DevOps project these days. So that's definitely a good connection right there. Well, Travis, again, thanks for your time coming on today, and we'll definitely hope to get you on sometime in the future as well.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm a big fan of the podcast, and I appreciate all the work you guys put into it.
Thanks so much for that support. Right then. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.